This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. At a moment when the people of Cuba await the passing of Fidel Castro and face an uncertain future, our guest T.J. English recalls a very different time in the Caribbean nation. He's written a new book about the Cuba of the 1950s, when a military dictatorship opened the nation to the American mob, which saw the island as a safe haven for gambling and prostitution. English describes a Havana teeming with American tourists, staying in swank, mob-owned hotels, gambling at casinos, dancing the mambo at nightclubs, and indulging their fantasies at live sex shows and bordellos. English believes the hedonism and sense of American exploitation fueled Castro's guerrilla movement, whose exploits lent a sense of exotic danger to Cuban tourism and eventually led to the downfall of the regime. T.J. English has written three previous books and numerous magazine pieces, as well as episodes of NYPD Blue and Homicide. I recently spoke to English about his new book, Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. Well, T.J. English, welcome back to Fresh Air. This book that you've written deals with a period in the 50s mostly when the American mob had its way in Havana. And I thought we would begin by listening to a clip from the movie The Godfather 2, which focuses on this period. And this is a scene in which the main Jewish mobster in the film, Hyman Roth, who is based on the real historical character of Meyer Lansky, is having a birthday party on a balcony in Havana, and he's meeting with a whole other American mobsters who are there and talking about their plans for the future. Let's listen.
These are wonderful things that we've achieved in Havana, and there's no limit to where we can go from here. This kind of government knows how to help business, to encourage it. The hotels here are bigger and swankier than any of the rough joints we put in Vegas. And we can thank our friends in the Cuban government, which has put up half of the cash with the Teamsters on a dollar-for-dollar basis, has relaxed restrictions on imports. What I'm saying is that we have now what we have always needed, real partnership with the government.
And that's Lee Strasberg playing Hyman Roth, the Meyer Lansky character in the film Godfather 2. T.J. English, this meeting of mobsters in Havana is actually predicated on a real event, right?
Yes, it is. That incident took place at the Hotel Nacional in Havana in 1946. It was a gathering of the brain trust of the mob in the United States at that time. All of them to meet in Havana to discuss the exploitation of Cuba, establishing Cuba as a kind of criminal base, which had been the dream of the American mob going all the way back to the 1920s.
Now, this plan to, in effect, sort of adopt Cuba as a safe haven for mob activity is, you know, took many, many years to get going. But a critical moment was in 1952 when Batista was, in effect, running Cuba at the time. And he brought Meyer Lansky back. And it's interesting that they quickly formed this close partnership. And the hotel and casino and nightclub scene in Havana flourished. And the mob began making a fortune. Tell us just a little bit about the financial relationships that made this possible. To what extent was the mob really running Cuba? And to what extent was the government of Cuba helping to finance the mob's operations?
Right. Well, there was a development institution known as Banco de Desarrollo Económico y Social, Bandes. It was a development institution controlled by the government that financed the building of bridges and highways and everything else on the island. There were also a couple of banks, Banco Atlantico y Banco de Créditos y Inversiones. These were banks that were controlled by the mob in Cuba, so that this tourism boom that was also part of this development of the criminal empire was all financed by mob money. So you would have the overflow of money from the casinos, which was phenomenal, that would flow into the nightclubs and also flow into the financial institutions like banks and development agencies, so that the very development of the country was being financed by the mob, by the criminal activity. And this is really kind of unprecedented in terms of the development of organized crime in the 20th century. This is something the mob had often dreamed of trying to pull off, but never had quite been able to put all the pieces together as they were able to finally do it in Cuba.
So when they get this thing really up and roaring, you have quite a scene in Havana. Just give us a picture a little bit of what Havana was like. Where were the tourists coming from and kind of what was the experience in the clubs and casinos in Havana?
Well, I wish I had been there. I was born in 1957, but I talked to a lot of people who passed through Havana and worked in Havana during this period of time, and it really is remembered as quite an extraordinary period. What you saw were the wonderful hotels that had the really some really beautiful casinos, unlike anything that existed anywhere else in the world at that time. You also had nightclubs that were extraordinary, like the Tropicana was located kind of in the jungle, just on the outer reaches of the city. And it was quite an alluring place. It had an outdoor theater under the stars surrounded by tropical foliage. And they staged a really elaborate nightclub shows in Cuba. They often used aspects of Afro-Cuban culture in the music and the dance. So they were quite exotic and sensual, if not sexual. And they attracted a flood of tourists, mostly from North America and from Europe, who came to Havana seeing it as one of the great entertainment scenes throughout history, in a way, because it really was a confluence of a kind of entertainment and sort of slightly dangerous feel to it, particularly as the revolution began to unfold. And we can certainly talk a bit about that. And so really what you had is this great entertainment era of dance and music and gambling and sex.
One of the slogans that Vegas uses today is what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And we live in an era where there's so much, you know, where sex and all kinds of hedonism is so much more a part of the culture than it was in the 1950s. Did airlines and travel agents and others talk about Havana as a place you could really go and just let it all out?
Oh, boy, did they ever. I mean, they really – see, this is part of what led to the revolution. There became this relationship between the criminal elements who were promoting Havana for their own reasons and large American corporations like Pan Am and the Hilton Hotel chain who were promoting Havana for their reasons. And so you started to see an intersection between the legitimate American corporate business entities and also the underworld entities. And so Havana was heavily promoted. You know, Havana had sort of existed in the consciousness of Americans for quite some time, probably beginning in the 1920s through the music and through Hollywood movies. And it had been promoted as kind of an exotic tourist destination that was, you know, just 90 miles off the coast of the state of Florida. And part of it was also that it was somewhat organic. I don't think even the mob anticipated the extent to which the Havana entertainment scene, the dance and music and just the kind of hot entertainment scene that it eventually became. Some of it grew out of Afro-Cuban culture. And it's just there was so much money around that the nightclubs were able to hire these huge orchestras, and they probably wouldn't have been able to if it had not been for the money that was generated by the casinos. And so you had orchestras like Perez Prado, who began the mambo craze, and all of this was really quite an extraordinary period in time for those who passed through it.
You know, sex and the sale of sex is always part of an escapist tourism scene. And there's a memorable scene in The Godfather, too, where the gang goes to a really, well, exotic sex club and sees a guy with a really exotic sex act. How kinky was the scene in Havana back then?
Well, that scene in The Godfather where they go to the theater, that is based on an actual theater, the Shanghai Theater, which was located in Havana's Chinatown. And it was an old a Chinese theater that had been converted into a kind of live sex emporium that was pretty kinky. I think about as kinky as you can get, although it also had a theatrical nature to it, You know, this just wasn't a strip club. It was a club where you would go where they would actually do kind of comical skits, often little theater pieces that were bawdy and usually ended with outright nudity, if not actual live sex acts being performed on the stage. I mean, a lot of the tourists that passed through Havana in the 1950s wanted to go to the Shanghai because it was notorious at the time. There was a performer there who went by the name of Superman, who was famous for the size of his appendage. And that's also portrayed in the movie The Godfather 2. And so stemming from that, you just had a lot of sex going on in Havana, ranging from just kind of tourists on the loose in an exotic foreign land, sexual tourism. But you also had prostitution, and you had sex performances. Along with the Shanghai Theater, they had private shows. You could go to a home in a kind of nice, discreet neighborhood in the city, and there in that home would be a kind of sex parlor, which you could view and perhaps even take part in. And so it was kind of a multi-leveled sexual marketplace that contributed to what was viewed as the allure of this whole entertainment era.
Tell us about American celebrities going to Havana. Sinatra, I mean, he was known for having friends in the mob. John F. Kennedy made it down there. Tell us about some of the, you know, better known excursions by American celebrities to Havana.
Right. Well, that was part of what would become the reputation of Havana in the 50s, was that it became this scene and that drew a lot of celebrities there. And so you would got celebrities like Marlon Brando, who came to Havana in the 1950s. He was drawn by the music and the women. Brando was a conga player, a bongo player, percussionist, amateur percussionist, and was down there to buy a drum, a conga drum, and also to take part in the music and the dancing. Errol Flynn, the actor Errol Flynn, was quite prominent there in the 1950s. Of course, Hemingway had been coming to Cuba since the 1930s and actually lived there in the 1950s, and so he was kind of a local mascot during this period of the 1950s. The casinos often hired celebrities. Capri Hotel hired the actor George Raft, who was kind of near the end of his career by that time, but he was famous for portraying mobsters and gangsters throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s in many, many movies. And they hired him as kind of meter and greeter at the casino at the Capri. He became another kind of mascot of the era. Yeah, that was a big part of it, the draw of the celebrities, partly the underworld allure, the connections to gangsters. That was certainly the case with Sinatra, who had many mobster friends. And keep in mind, gambling was legal in Havana, and so you could go to the casinos and hang out with known mobsters, and since you were outside the United States, it really wasn't going to cause you any problems with the law.
While the mob is having its fun in Havana and making a fortune, and tourists are streaming in, and this hedonistic nightclub culture flourishes, a guerrilla movement grows in the eastern part of the island, led by Fidel Castro, the son of a landlord who was a student and intellectual. And we don't really have time, I guess, to describe how the revolution develops. You describe it really one big improvisation, a whole series of disasters that that befall it. But eventually it takes hold and begins to get more support and become a real threatening force in the late 50s. To what extent did the mob scene and the nightclub and casino scene in Havana fuel the revolution? To what extent was resentment at that form of American exploitation, if we want to call it that, driving force for the revolution?
Yes, I think this is, this is the most important point of the book, because, you know, this period of the mob in Havana has been alluded to in movies and novels. And of course, the revolution, there have been dozens and dozens of books written about the Cuban Revolution. But the two events are usually treated as if they kind of were unrelated. And in the course of researching the book, I could see that here were these events, this exploitation of Havana and the revolution, sort of they were unfolding at the same time. So, of course, they had to have had some sort of relationship. And I think what it was is the exploitation of Havana, the plundering of Havana economically and turning it into a kind of a bordello, was a symbol to the revolution of the capitalist exploitation that was taking place through the Batista regime. The Castro and the revolution saw the mob and the capitalists who were operating in Havana kind of as all one entity. And so what was taking place in Havana really became a symbolic motivation for the revolution, a driving motivation for the revolution in a way.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, the fact that the rebels were making some progress and there were acts of sabotage made the Havana scene all seem that much more dangerous. This, of course, comes to a climax on New Year's Eve 1958, December 31st, 1958. And it was known that the rebels had made progress and were getting closer to Havana. Did the fact that there was some sense that – and Batista was seen as perhaps being increasingly isolated and on his last legs – did any of that prevent the nightclubs from holding big New Year's Eve celebrations? Did they have any sense that of how close the revolution was to taking over?
No, I think it just added to the excitement of the nightlife scene in Cuba at the time. See, the revolution was unfolding on the island mostly outside of Havana, and Havana was kind of this little dream world where all this kind of money was flowing and people were dancing and drinking and fornicating into the tropical night. And so they didn't really pay much attention to what was happening around the rest of the island. And since Batista controlled the media on the island, there was propaganda that led people to believe that Batista had things under control and everything was okay. There were intimations of it because, like you say, there was occasional acts of sabotage, bombs that would go off in the city of Havana, even in the Tropicana nightclub, a bomb was set off. But this only added to the excitement in a way. And so you kind of have a frenzy, a peaking as the revolution, as rumor of the revolution grows and grows. The excitement of the nightlife scene in Havana at the time only became more heated and exciting.
So New Year's Eve, people are partying the night away. And then somewhere in the middle of the night, Batista quietly resigns and leaves the island with zillions of dollars.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is you describe how Meyer Lansky, I mean the American mobster, who is in many respects the architect of all of this, learns of the events. Tell us about what he heard and what he did.
Yeah, well, I had a great source on this. I had a number of good sources on this, but the best source, I dedicated the book to a man by the name of Armando Jaime Casillas, who was Lansky's driver and bodyguard and valet during the last 2 years of this period, 57, 58, on into 59. And he had become quite close to Lansky and was with Lansky that night. And Lansky, he caught wind of it. The revolution at that time was coming very close to Cuba. They were in the city of Las Villas. Che Guevara led a column of soldiers that had taken the city of Las Villas. So everyone knew that the revolution was approaching, and Lansky actually got word that the city of Las Villas had fell and that Batista had fled the country. Batista had loaded up a lot of cash, and without telling the mobsters or anyone else, he'd got on an airplane and left the country right after midnight on January 1st, 1959. And so Lansky is given this information discreetly before anyone else really knows it when he's at this restaurant. And he immediately kicks into action. And his first concern, of course, and it makes perfect sense, is get the money. He tells Armando Jaime Casillas, we've got to make the rounds to all the casinos. We've got to make sure that the counting rooms are secure, that the money is secure. The island is going to fall. It could get violent. It could get heated. And we have to protect our assets. So there was a frenzied night and into the early morning of Lansky and his driver bodyguard driving around to the different casino hotels and trying to make sure that the cash was secured so that if they needed to get it off the island, they would at least have it all gathered and ready to go.
Now, Lansky gets word before the populace does, but as he's proceeding through trying to secure these enormous amounts of cash that the casinos have generated, word begins to leak out of Batista's departure. How did the citizens of Havana react?
Well, there was it took a while because no one quite believed it when they first started to hear it, and the word spread through the streets of Havana, and people were kind of stunned by it. It wasn't the kind of thing that would make its way into the media because the government controlled the media, and so it was just wild rumor for a while. But as time went on and people got a sense of what was happening, they started to gather in the streets. It became a kind of a combination celebration and riot all rolled into one. And one of the most telling things about it was by the early morning, as huge mobs of people started to flow through the streets of Havana, making music and cheering revolutionary slogans, one of the first things they did was target the casinos. They went into a number of the casinos and trashed the casinos and dragged gambling equipment out into the streets and set it on fire. So this was a really clear example of the degree to which the casinos and the gambling and the whole presence of the mob in Havana had become a source of resentment, anger, and even revolutionary fervor that eventually boiled over on the morning of January 1st, 1959.
And the actor George Raft was doing his usual business greeting people at, was it the Capri Casino?
Yes, it was.
And what happened?
The people and the Revolutionary Guard stormed into the casino at the time when he was there. He was determined to save the place. And so he tells the story. There are other eyewitness accounts of this story. His version of it from his biography is, of course, the most flattering to him of how he stood up to the revolutionaries. And one of the lead revolutionaries who was there to trash the casino looked at him and said to the others, she said, "That's George Raft, the actor." So they all kind of stopped, a recognizable face. And he said to them, "Look, you know, take what you want, but there's no need to trash the casinos." And so the legend is that he kind of talked them down and saved the Capri Hotel Casino from being trashed.
The reach of celebrity.
Yes.
Well, so the mobsters who were able to secure the cash from the casinos get away, and they gather at the home of one of the mobsters, Joe Stassi, who, as you describe it, was sort of the typical meeting place for folks to gather throughout the years and discuss their common interests in the hotel and casino industry. Mm-hmm. So this is New Year's Eve. The country is falling to the rebels. There's chaos in the streets. And all these mobsters have tried to get their take, and they convene at Joe Stassi's house. What's the scene there?
Yeah, they get the cash, as much of it together as they can, and they all convene at Joe Stassi's beautiful house, which I saw myself, which is located in a nice ritzy neighborhood in Havana. And they divide up the money, and they basically try to, they're in a state of shock and frenzy and panic at the time. And so they're not sure whether they should flee or whether they should stay and try to deal with the new government. There's a lot of mixed feelings about what's the best way to proceed. Some of them will leave the island that night. Lots of people are fleeing the island, by the way. Anyone who's sort of easily identified with the Batista government is fears for their life, believes that they're maybe going to be imprisoned and even assassinated once the revolution comes to Havana. So there's this kind of general sense of panic among the mobsters as they gather together what they can in the way of cash and try to decide what their next step is going to be.
And, you know, if you look at a position of someone like Lansky, I mean, there was back then it wasn't so clear exactly what kind of government Fidel Castro would set up. And if you're Meyer Lansky, you've put, I guess, tens or hundreds of millions in investment into this place. It's making a fortune. And you figure that this new government is not going to want to give up all that cash, all that foreign exchange. So you might be able to deal with them. On the other hand, they might shoot you. What did Lansky decide to do?
Yeah, this was the most fascinating phase of the story to me. What did the mob do after Havana fell, after Castro came into Havana, which he did on January 8th. He finally arrived in the city. And so now the revolution has taken over. And the mob is caught in this in-between phase of trying to just see if they can salvage whatever they can salvage, or are they just going to have to lose everything and leave the island. And Lansky, and also one of his primary partner in the Havana mob was a mafiosi by the name of Santo Traficante Jr. from Tampa, Florida. These two men kind of were the controlling gambling impresarios on the island. And both of them maybe were in a denial to an extent. Traficante in particular believed that this was all just going to blow over and that Castro would be no different than all the other people who had run Cuba over many decades, that they would need the gambling money, that the money generated by the casinos and the nightclubs really was what was keeping the island afloat, and that they wouldn't be able to cut that off or the economy would collapse. And so the mobsters, Lansky and Traficante, placed a lot of faith in this belief and started a process of negotiating with the revolutionary government over the course of a few weeks and months on into the middle of 1959. And it just started to become apparent to them that this was something different, that Castro government was not just another government taking over in Cuba, that it was a true revolution, and that, the last straw was that the Revolutionary Guard wanted to have rebels in the counting rooms in the casino to monitor the money as it came into the casino, because they knew the gangsters were skimming money from the casino when it went directly into their bank accounts. And so the Castro government, if they were going to allow the casinos to operate, they were going to make sure that they got their piece of the pie. And that's when the mobsters saw that this was an untenable situation. There's no way we would be able to exist with this government. That was made emphatically clear in early 1961 when the Castro government finally took over ownership of all American businesses on the islands, not only the casinos, but the holdings of Shell Oil Company and the Hilton Hotel Company and all the major American corporations that had flourished and benefited from this mobster exploitation of Cuba throughout the 1950s.
You traveled to Cuba to research this book.
Yes.
To what extent is this period of underworld domination, now decades ago, still a part of the Cuban popular or national consciousness?
Well, I think it's the Rosetta Stone. It's the most important thing to know to understand the revolution and why it happened, and also the relationship between Cuba and the United States that has existed since 1959, the animosity, the deep resentment and hatred. A lot of it has to do with the capitalist exploitation of Havana that took place in the 1950s, the belief that the gangsters, the organized crime figures, and the heads of the so-called legitimate American corporations and American politicians were all kind of in it together. And this has been used over the many decades by Castro and others within the revolution as a kind of a call to arms, a reason why we could never trust the United States government because of its criminal connections and criminal roots. And in modern day Havana today, you still see the remnants of this era through the casinos are all gone, but many of the hotels are still there. The Nacional, the Hotel Riviera, which was Lansky's baby, and a few others. And this era in general still exists in Havana. Havana kind of froze in 1959. So anyone who's been there knows this kind of surreal atmosphere of American cars from the 1940s and 50s, the architecture, which really hasn't changed much. It's all still there. It's crumbling and broken down, but it's still very much a visible presence in Havana when you were there. So in terms of research, it was very easy to recapture the spirit and atmosphere of this time just by walking the streets of Havana.
Well, T.J. English, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
T.J. English. His new book is Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. Since Congress enacted the law opening new athletic opportunities for women, known as Title IX, in 1972, America has seen an explosion of women's participation in sports. Women's collegiate championships are regularly broadcast on national television, and more than a million girls now play high school soccer, basketball, lacrosse, and volleyball. But our guest, Mike Sokolov, says there's also been an explosion in injuries to female athletes, with serious knee injuries occurring at rates several times higher than those among male athletes. Sokolov says the damage is due partly to differences between men's and women's bodies, particularly in the teen years, and partly to what he calls the insanity of our youth sports culture. His book says there are things parents can and should do to protect their kids. Sokolov is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and the author of two earlier books. His latest is Warrior Girls, Protecting Our Daughters Against the Injury Epidemic in Women's Sports. Well, Michael Sokolov, welcome back to Fresh Air. Since Title IX was enacted in 1972, which ensured women and girls' access to athletic opportunities in school, we've seen an enormous increase in their participation, tenfold. What's the price we're paying in injuries to our daughters?
The price is just this raft of injuries in community after community. Knee injuries have gotten a lot of attention. Girls suffer injuries to their ACL, which is the stabilizing ligament in the knee, and which is a horrendous injury when it is ruptured, at times 5 to 8 times greater than boys do and in sports that they play in common. And this is mostly the pivoting and cutting sports of basketball, volleyball, soccer, field hockey to some extent. But it's not just the knee injuries that have gotten a lot of attention. From head to toe, back pain, ankle pain, concussions. When you go across communities, you see entire teams of girls where you'll see 18 girls and 8 of them with major injuries, sometimes with lifelong consequences, by the time the season is over.
Now, you write about Amy Stedman, who was once one of the most promising young soccer players in the nation. I'd like you to describe meeting her, what she was like when you first met her, and just tell us a bit of her story.
Well, Amy was going to be one of the great soccer players of her generation. She was captain of the U.S. under-19 team. She was just this wonderful, spirited, fast player and was going to go off to the University of North Carolina. Before she could get there, she tore her ACL. She went on to tear it 3 more times. She had a series of surgeries. By the time I met Amy, she was 20 years old. She was done playing. I met her down at the University of North Carolina. And as she walked toward me that first time, if I had not known her history, I would have never believed she had been an athlete, let alone an elite athlete. She walked very stiffly. She was in a great deal of pain. And we sat there for close to 3 hours that first time we talked. And she just described this litany of injuries and surgeries to me and described the last one that she had had, in which the doctor said to her when she came out of anesthesia, Amy, there was nothing in there left to fix. And that just, you know, in 3 decades of journalism, it has been rare for me to have to hold back my own emotions. It was such a sad story to be told by someone I had known to be this wonderful athlete. Amy is retired now. She can't play anymore and is looking at having an artificial knee probably by the time she's 30 years old.
Let's talk about some physiology here. How are the differences between boys' and girls' bodies, particularly as they take up sports, contributing to this rash of injuries?
When girls and boys move into puberty, and when they move through puberty, boys add muscle. They get stronger, often without much effort of their own. Girls do not get appreciably stronger, but girls get more flexible. When that flexibility is not accompanied by strength, you know, good old-fashioned muscle to keep joints stable, that leads to injuries. So what we're seeing is these girls being asked to play extraordinary schedules, 5, 6, 7 times a week, to specialize in one sport, you know, by the time they reach puberty, if not much earlier, to play that sport 9, 10, 11 months a year, and their bodies are not holding up to it.
You know, you had an interesting idea, I think, in trying to get a sense of kind of the prevalence of these injuries, and that was to go to the military, where women have now been serving for several years and have to go through the grueling exercise of basic training. And there's some evidence on the frequency of injuries among women. What did you find in the military?
I tapped into some fascinating research in Army basic training. They have tracked their injuries going back a couple of decades. And what the Army knows is that women are much more often injured in basic training. Lower extremity injuries, stress fractures, they don't broadcast this because gender in the military is a sensitive subject, just as it is in sports. But what the Army also knows is that women are tougher than the men. It takes a much bigger injury to drive a woman out of basic training than it does to drive a man out of basic training. So you have to ask, well, why is that? Some people imagine or assume that women have a higher pain tolerance. The research, by the way, does not necessarily back that up or does not do that definitively. I think that women in the Army, as in sports, are still relative newcomers, and they are perhaps trying to prove their bona fides. And one of the ways that you prove your bona fides in the military or in sports is to play through pain. And I believe that that is absolutely what's going on our playing fields with young women, not of Army basic training age, but 12 and 13 and 14-year-old women, or young women who are being encouraged to play through pain or feel that it's something that they must do, or perhaps have played in so much pain since they began playing sports that they're inured to it.
You border upon the politically incorrect message here that women are dainty, delicate things that shouldn't be putting cleats on and tearing up an athletic field. And there are, of course, strong advocates for women's sports out there, people who have fought to make Title IX a reality and open up athletic budgets and athletic opportunities to women. What are they seeing in terms of injury rates? Do they see a problem?
In the course of researching this book, every parent and every young athlete I talked to was very glad for me to be doing this book. They said, thank you for looking into this. Because in each community, people tend to think, wow, this is happening on my team. What a stroke of bad luck. Or this has happened to my daughter. And then at a certain point, they realize, well, this is bigger than that. And it is, in fact, a nationwide trend. And they said, well, thank you for investigating this. Thank you for trying to highlight some research and talking about some solutions. There were women's sports advocates who said to me, well, you better watch what you write. You better be careful what you write, which, of course, I was. I'm an advocate of women's sports. I have a daughter who is a college athlete. But what I found was injury rates, they're just simply unacceptable. And I understand that the history of gender research that identifies differences has always come out as often come out as justifying bias against women. So I certainly understand their caution on this. When we look at men and we say men have more heart attacks or men get prostate cancer, we don't see that as a sign of weakness. We don't say men are the weaker sex. But when we point out differences, and like these, people will often say, oh, well, women shouldn't be playing. Well, that is not my point at all. My point is that women need to train differently than men train. They need to be recognized as different physical beings, should probably be coached more by women coaches. And across the youth culture, boys and girls are playing too much. They're specializing too early. It's not good for either gender, but what I found is that it's too often disastrous for girls. So when someone says, oh, you shouldn't write this, I would just say, well, what is the alternative? That we pretend these statistics don't exist, that we pretend this problem doesn't exist because it sounds somehow politically incorrect or it may lead to bias. I say, let's face it squarely. Let's say girls should play, they should play hard, they should play as competitively as they want to play, but let's change the whole terrain so that they don't walk off the field whenever they're done with their sport as if they played a decade in the NFL. That's just not acceptable.
You discovered that there are some exercise regimens that are specifically designed to help female athletes prevent knee injuries, the ACL injuries that have been so troublesome. Just describe what those are like and tell us what the evidence is that they work.
These programs focus on landing from jumps and decelerating, and they teach girls simply to play in what old gym coaches used to call the athletic position, which is knees bent and butt down. They are very routine warm-up programs, plyometrics, which is balancing. There's a program in Santa Monica called the PEP program, which is one of the larger programs. They claim to be able to decrease the rate of ACL injuries in young women by as much as 80%. You know, if they do a quarter of that, it's worth doing. And it is simple preventative medicine, which can be boring. It can be hard. You know, everyone wants to go out to a soccer field and start kicking the ball, or to the basketball court and start shooting the ball. What these programs do is say, let's stop and let's retrain your body to move in a way that is more protective.
If you're just joining us, our guest is writer Michael Sokolov. His new book about the epidemic of injuries in women's sports is called Warrior Girls. One of the things you say in this book and spend some time on is the notion that we need to think, as you write it, more deeply about the insanity of our youth sports culture. And there are several aspects to this. I mean, one of them is specialization. Now, you know, when I was a kid, we played baseball in the spring and summer, football in the fall, and basketball in the winter. And we kind of rolled around and played different sports depending upon what the guys on TV were doing. It's different these days, isn't it? What happens now?
What happens is that a child begins playing perhaps two or three sports. By the age of 9 or 10, especially if she shows some promise, some coach approaches her or approaches her parents and says, hey, she's pretty good. I want to move her up a level. Puts her on the team. She begins playing 4 months a year, then 6 months a year. And at some point, very early on, the coach says, you know, you need to play in the fall season as well as the spring season, and you also need to play indoors during the winter. And before you know it, she's playing 10 months a year, one sport, which is the absolute worst thing that you can do physically or psychologically in an approach to sports. And it is a direct injury cause.
You know, it's interesting how, as you describe in the book, big-name coaches aren't saying anything about these injuries. Athletic directors aren't being aggressive about it. And when you talk to them, I think one or two of them said, well, that's your job to raise this issue. As you mentioned, you wrote a cover story in the New York Times Magazine about this. What has been the reaction?
People who have read the book and read the excerpt in the New York Times Magazine, I got a lot of reaction from athletes and from adult women who had suffered injuries and read the piece as I hoped the piece would be read, which is a serious look at this syndrome and a serious look at coming to grips with it and making changes in the sports culture and educating young women and their parents as to what can be done to decrease these injuries. There were certainly people who read it very politically. There's a great women's blog, Jezebel, very snarky, very lively blog. And on Jezebel, it was alleged that I was, you know, standing in the way of progress for women's sports. And I think it's just the opposite. I think that what threatens women's sports and the further evolution of women's sports and the further expansion of it is injuries, not the few troglodytes who say, well, women shouldn't be playing these sports. We're not going to get very far if we have so many of these girls leaving the field broken up and in pain.
Well, Michael Sokolov, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Writer Michael Sokolov, his book is Warrior Girls, Protecting Our Daughters Against the Injury Epidemic in Women's Sports. You can read an excerpt from the first chapter of the book and download podcasts of our show at our website, freshair.npr.org.